The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A week of pageantry and drama comes to an end with some political drama in Washington, D.C. Did John Boehner have a come-to-Jesus moment in the last 24 hours? The Speaker of the House announced his resignation today, avoiding a battle with GOP conservatives and possibly avoiding another government shutdown. Boehner spent yesterday visibly sobbing as the Pope spoke in the House chambers at Boehner's invitation. Today, the announcement of his resignation was texted to House members in a very quiet bombshell. Is this a bombshell or the simple reality that someone had to blink? Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, which is it?
John, I hate to use a cliche, but it's a little bit of both. Look, the speaker's hold on his gavel, on his seat, has been in question for a long time, and much more in question recently when the threat to his rule over the House, his speakership, had become very, very real. That's one part of it. But was this a bombshell this morning? Absolutely. Nobody expected this. I got an email from one member of Congress who is in the room who used those words. Absolute bombshell, said people were stunned. Everybody else coming out of the room says people were stunned. The majority leader, Kevin McCarthy, the deputy, the possible, although not definite, heir apparent to the speakership, wasn't told until minutes before. So absolutely a surprise. Nobody saw this coming except Boehner and probably his very, very closest staff and I guess his wife.
I was reading some of the analysis of this, the instant analysis of this, which you could take with a grain of salt, right? But how would this avoid a government shutdown?
Well, it might in the sense that if John Boehner doesn't have to worry about appeasing the growing list of conservatives who say they'll oust him if he doesn't play along on Planned Parenthood and the other issues that are part of the government shutdown scenario, then he can do any number of things. Don't forget, the House passes things by a majority. Can he pass a spending bill next week with a majority that doesn't fund Planned Parenthood? Yes, of course, he can do it easily by turning to Nancy Pelosi and getting a whole slew of Democratic votes. He can do that. The problem with that scenario is that it's hard to stay Speaker after doing that. If he's not worried about staying Speaker anymore, he can turn to Democrats and pass that bill rather easily if that's what he chooses to do.
It's possible this is a kind of principled decision in the sense that he may have decided with the Pope up there, I'm a principled Catholic, and this is against my religion, you know, to endorse anything to do with Planned Parenthood. And he just doesn't want to go compromising with Democrats at this point. It's all speculation, but maybe that's what's going on here.
No, except John Boehner told members inside the conference meeting this morning that he decided this long ago, that he in fact was going to leave a year and a half ago, except that Eric Cantor, the former majority leader, that his defeat in his own primary convinced Boehner to stay on longer than he had even planned himself, John. So I want to shy you away from the notion that somehow Boehner had a real come-to-Jesus moment once he finally got the Pope to speak to Congress and decided he had reached the pinnacle and that he was going to bow out. No, he's told members that he made this decision a while ago, that he's been planning on this, that over the next several months of fights over government spending, that he doesn't want to be the story. He doesn't want the focus to be on him. He told them that it would be damaging to the institution if there were a power struggle and a speaker fight going on while Republicans are trying to get the government funded, deal with Democrats. Oh, and by the way, there's a fractious Republican primary. If there is a speaker fight inside of the Capitol, all of that would point to a disorganized and infighting Republican Party. Boehner doesn't want that.
Although, do you buy that year and a half scenario? I mean, you've worked with Boehner, you've talked with him, he knows you, you know the GOP caucus. I mean, is that cover?
There's no way for me to know for sure, except if you're asking me for my impression, John, a lot of it does ring true. This scenario of Boehner struggling with the conservatives being under threat, it's not new. It's a lot more real this week where we're all saying, wow, he could actually be ousted at the end of next week if he doesn't play this right. Like, the threat has been very real. But the threat itself isn't new. And you have to remember back when Eric Cantor was majority leader.
Right.
Back then, we were covering an infighting Republican conference then, with Cantor making pretty overt moves that weren't a secret that he was angling for Boehner's job and that he might be organizing a coup. And back then, those two staffs, those two offices, those two seats, they were fighting almost an open warfare. Now, they managed to quash it. They managed to shake hands, at least in public. And then some 18 months later, Cantor was gone anyway. But am I surprised that Boehner would say that he was thinking about stepping down even back then? No, I'm not, because no speaker would want to be ousted in a floor vote. That's not usually how they go out. They go out when they realize the handwriting's on the wall and they resign. They don't go out by a vote of no confidence, which is what Boehner might have been facing here.
Finally, are the casualties of this ouster going to be an intelligent debate on immigration reform, on climate change, on the discussion of prison reform that seems to have some bipartisan consensus?
Hard to tell, except those first two examples that you gave were non-starters in the House to begin with. Comprehensive immigration reform, John, passed the Senate with 67 votes. Remember? We all remember that. Went nowhere in the House, in part because of this dynamic. Even back then, people were saying, well, you know, it all depends. If John Boehner's actually planning on resigning at the end of the year, he could pass immigration reform, pass it with a few Republicans and lots of Democrats. Never happened, right? Climate change has never gone anywhere in the House, not under Republican leadership. It's hard to imagine that conversation changing. Criminal justice reform might be a different issue. The coalition, the bipartisan desire for that reform is much, much more broad. It does transcend the different ideological factions. I can't tell you that they're going to get it done 100%, but that's not the same political dynamic or conference dynamic in the House as those other two things are.
It's a new day. Todd Zwillick, have a great weekend. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, John.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. The Saudi government keeps a tight lid on all kinds of criticism. The kingdom's hold on the Muslim holy places is one of the few issues where it receives widespread objections to its brutal police state style and legitimacy. For decades, Muslim nations have called for Mecca to be a city unto itself, like the Vatican, administered for the good of all Muslims rather than, as some have described it, a Saudi religious trophy. Much harder to penetrate is the Saudi silence over political prisoners held behind bars, monitored by human rights activists but unknown, particularly in the United States, which has such a confused and troubled alliance with the Saudi kingdom. Take the case of Walid Abu Al-Kheir, human rights lawyer and Nobel Peace Prize nominee. He was imprisoned for his activism in 2014, which included encouraging and hosting debate on religion and politics in his home. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison, a sentence that the Saudis have shown no inclination to change, despite international pleas that he be released and a petition calling for Al-Kheir's release. Daniel Arshak is one of the lawyers for Walid Abu Al-Kheir.
Walid is perhaps the world's leading human rights activist in the Middle East. He worked as a criminal defense attorney in Saudi Arabia for many years, and in 2013 was arrested for doing exactly what human rights defenders do around the world every day, representing clients who are advocating for their own human rights.
Has he been charged with a crime?
Yes, he was. He was charged with a crime on October 2nd of 2013. Those charges included organizing an illegal gathering, which amounted to some friends and people who wanted to think and talk about increasing democracy in Saudi Arabia at his home. He was charged with a crime. He was brought to trial. And in the middle of that trial, he was charged yet again for the exact same offenses, but this time in the Saudi Arabian security court put together to combat terrorism, violent Islamic terrorism in Saudi Arabia. And he began a course of going to court over and over on those two cases. Ultimately, at the end of October of 2013, he was sentenced on the first case on the same charges to 3 months in jail. And ultimately then in April of 2014, he was detained at the fifth hearing of the more serious charges, or the more serious court on the same charges. And then in July of 2014, was sentenced to 15 years in jail for being a human rights advocate in Saudi Arabia.
How sensitive is the Saudi government to any form of dissidence or criticism or political activism?
Well, as an indication of the answer to that question, Walid elected not to have an attorney represent him in Saudi Arabia because he knew very well that whoever stood up to represent him, as defense attorneys do for their clients all around the world every day, that person was likely to end up with the same fate as he did in a jail cell beside him. So the answer to your question is the Saudis are completely intolerant to any sort of criticism. Let's remember. We talk about the Saudis. The Saudis are a family, one family that purchased Saudi Arabia. It's a monarchy. They run the show. They're immensely wealthy. They decide who lives, who dies, who works, who doesn't work, who holds a home, who gets an education. And so any effort at criticism of the government or opening of Saudi society to women's rights, to free speech, is viewed as an attack on their power base.
Does the U.S. government buy that line? It seems as though the U.S. government is hesitant to criticize the Saudis, and attempts to get President Obama to take this case up were unsuccessful when King Salman was here.
There's a bit of a disconnect between what our government says and what our government does. It was, I have to say, as a advocate for Waleed, it was horrifying to see our president, who we all had such high hopes for 8 years ago, sit and play patty cakes with King Salman when he came to the United States. In 2013, the State Department issued a statement, a report, decrying the fact that individuals are charged for free speech, identifying Waleed Abu al-Khair as someone who should not ever have been prosecuted. They repeated that again in 2014. 8 United States senators, including people from as divergent political views as Marco Rubio, Patrick Leahy, Richard Durbin, Dianne Feinstein, all got together in a letter and sent it to the King of Saudi Arabia and said, this has to stop. This sort of political intolerance has to stop. And that, of course, isn't that exactly what Pope Francis is calling for on his visit to the United States and around the world?
Do the Saudis have so much leverage in the United States that they can suppress this sort of thing? There's a lot of concern about the Saudis' reaction to the Iran nuclear deal. They don't like it. They're perceived as going it alone in Yemen, and that the leverage the U.S. has over the Saudis, if it even existed, is diminishing.
Well, look, the Saudis have more money than any other country of similar size on earth. They don't need the United States. They have oil and they sell oil, and that propels them to make decisions that is always the best for maintaining their own power base. Does the United States need them? The United States identifies Saudi Arabia as a prime ally within the region. That doesn't mean that they ought to be immune from criticism. And it was so troubling just this week. You know, the New York Times reported that Abdul Rahman Shalabi, who was the former driver and bodyguard to Osama bin Laden, was released from Guantanamo, something that we all applaud. This man was held for 13 years in our prison in Guantanamo without ever being charged with a crime. And finally, our president, keeping his promise that he made to us 8 years ago to start closing Guantanamo, he released him. And where did he release him to? He released him to Saudi Arabia. Wasn't that a moment? Wasn't that a moment that President Obama could have stood up and, excuse me, grown a pair and said, King Salman, now is the time for you to release peaceful advocates in your country who are calling for democratic change?
Daniel Arshak, thanks so much.
And thank you for having me.
Daniel Arshak is a lawyer for imprisoned Saudi human rights lawyer Waleed Abu al-Khair.
You want answers?
You haven't answered my question.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
So, do you come to Milwaukee often?
You know how fast you were going?
How can we be expected to teach children to learn how to read if they can't even fit inside the building?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
You can't handle the truth!
We can handle Rafer and Kristen. They're both here. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. They are the Movie Date podcast, here to review the movies of the week. Welcome, guys.
Happy Friday,
hey, John.
Happy Friday, indeed. Let's start right away with The Intern. Now, this is a deceptively new premise, but actually it's kind of an old premise. Let's hear a clip.
Oh, thanks, but you don't have to. I can open the door. Sure. Okay, so this shouldn't take more than an hour, but if you can't stay here, I'll call Becky, and then she'll find you, and then you can just pull up.
Don't worry. I'll be here.
think I forgot to eat today.
Should I pick you up some sushi?
So we've got Anne Hathaway and Robert De Niro. How does this go?
All right. So Anne Hathaway is an overextended online fashion mogul. She has this startup and she's just working and working and working and working. She starts this new senior intern program. And Robert De Niro is one of the interns who's working with her. And of course, he turns out to be not just an intern, but also a confidant, a caretaker, a best friend, all those things. Of course, it's totally schlocky. It's ridiculous. It's predictable. And yet I also found everybody really likable, and I ended up really enjoying this movie.
It's like Mrs. Doubtfire without the costume.
It's really very charming, and I think Kristen's right. Not much actually happens. I kept waiting for the older generation to teach the younger generation something and vice versa. That doesn't really happen. Everyone just kind of gets along really well, and Robert De Niro's nice, and Anne Hathaway's pretty nice. I think it wouldn't work if you didn't have two great stars, and also Nancy Meyers, writer-director, who did Baby Boom and It's Complicated and The Parent Trap. And when I left, I thought, well, that was totally meaningless and trivial, but also really enjoyable and fun.
People being nice with smiles on their faces. What's wrong with that? Movie number two, Green Inferno. Now, this is an unusual offering this weekend, and it's got a debate going.
It does. This is sort of the opposite of the intern. Not a lot of smiles on people's
right.
faces. It's a bunch of Western do-gooders, college-age types who get together. They're going to go to Peru, chain themselves to some trees, and stop the evil corporations from encroaching on the land of the native tribes people. And the native tribes people wind up hunting them down for dinner. It's the latest from Eli Roth, the horror director. And there's been some debate because some NGOs and nonprofits have said this is a very racist, retrograde film that encourages harmful stereotypes of the villagers.
Is this studio or indie, this film?
It's Chris? Indie. It's Eli Roth. He's definitely more of an indie maker.
Yeah.
It's been around for a while, too. It's been around since at least 2013 or so.
But I do have to say, Rafer, I do think it is racist.
I do
think this is just completely racist garbage. At times, it's very gratifying to see these sanctimonious activists get their due, but at the same time, it's so horrible. None of the native peoples actually get any of their lines translated. None of them are treated like humans. They're all complete monsters in this depiction.
And is this in wide release?
Yes, it is.
This is indeed, yes. I thought it was hilarious. I got a big kick out of it. I thought it was really funny watching these college-age students go out and get hunted down by the tribes people.
It's remarkably gross.
Of course. It's a cannibal film. It's a cannibal film, and it's a throwback to all the schlocky, horrible, disreputable cannibal films of the 60s and 70s. I thought it was a lot of fun and very funny.
But even the way it was made was exploitative. Eli Roth actually said he went into the rainforest, and he got these people who'd never even seen cameras to act out and pantomime all these roles. I just feel like even the making of the film's a problem.
Sounds like a bad episode of Gilligan's Island. What's on the podcast?
Well, we were very lucky to talk with PJ O'Rourke because we have this new movie, Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead, which is a documentary about National Lampoon. He's a National Lampoon alum, and he talked with us all about the heyday.
Grumpy old PJ. Was he in a good mood?
Oh, he was hilarious.
He was delightful.
All right, fantastic. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the podcast. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks, John.
You too, John.
Thousand people will gather at Madison Square Garden in New York City tonight to attend Mass led by Pope Francis. There will be a lot of devout Catholics in attendance. All of the O'Neills, the Scalias, the Diazes, the Hesses, the Vizinskis will all be there to see the Pope. But not all in attendance will be devout, lifelong Catholics. Francis, the brightest light in the Catholic world, has attracted many skeptics, lapsed Catholics, and non-Catholics to witness his message of inclusion and calls for global change regardless of religious beliefs. Our own Jim O'Grady, reporter for our partner WNYC, will be there. Jim, which are you, lapsed, devout, curious, non-Catholic?
I think of myself as a bread-in-the-bone Catholic. I was raised in a Catholic household, went to Catholic schools. I still see the world through that prism, though I may not practice as much as I did. And I think the Church and the Pope is actually important.
And that whole narrative lives within you. You were there 36 years ago when John Paul II came here the first time.
Yeah, this was 1979. I was a so-called Catholic youth, and Pope John Paul II, newly elected as Pope, was visiting the United States in New York City, and it was announced that he would hold a Catholic youth rally at Madison Square Garden. So me and my fellow youths were put on buses and sent down to Manhattan to attend. We were not asked if we wanted to go, because this is the era of Catholic culture where you just did as you were told.
This was compulsory. Yeah.
This was compulsory. So the buses arrived. As I recall, they set us into the streets a few blocks from Madison Square Garden. We started walking down 7th Avenue, and we entered a bazaar of papal paraphernalia. This was the first time that God had met commerce in this way, because the Pope had just emerged as a global, telegenic, media-friendly figure.
Very different from Pope Paul, his predecessor.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we have a little tape of Pope Paul VI. He was the first pope to come to the United States in 1965 to address the United Nations. And this is what he sounded like.
We are obliged to deplore every war in its causes, in its inhuman violence.
And that was the style of the popes. They had this medieval mustiness clinging to them.
Right.
And then you have Pope John Paul II, and then you have him arriving in New York, where what do? We commoditize things. We turn things into products, and we sell them, and we make money. So we're walking past stands that are selling Pope on a rope, where you could get His Holiness and it's carved into a piece of soap. Of course, we take this for granted now. There are Francis bobblehead dolls in every shop window in Manhattan. And we don't think twice about this. We just think this is the way it goes. The Pope is a popular culture figure, as well as being a religious leader. But it was all very new in 1979.
Did that drive the Pope's message deeper into you as you listen to it, seeing that he was something of a rock star then, and of course, even more now?
I think it woke people up, especially Catholics, and made the Pope seem more relevant. Here was this Pope who was young and relatively young, he was 58 years old, with a message for modern ears. So we get into Madison Square Garden, doors open, the Popemobile arrives, there he is, the crowd goes wild. The Popemobile sort of makes a circuit. John Paul II gets up on stage, sits down, leans into the mic to start a speech, an address to the young people. But the chanting and the cheering just keeps going and going. They won't let him speak. And so finally he starts to make sounds, these sounds. He starts to woo. And it was both bizarre and confusing, and we were later told that this is a sort of a traditional Polish response to a crowd. And it just whipped the crowd into even more of a frenzy, and it just went on and on and on, and then it crescendoed.
Oh, the call of the Pope.
That's the Pope. Wow. But that is also the sign of a gifted performer who is meeting the crowd where they are. And then finally, the crowd calmed down and the Pope began his speech.
Dear young people, I am happy to be with you in Madison Square Gardens.
How did you feel?
It's weird. I felt like something strange and new was occurring. I wondered if we were breaking protocol. I wonder if this was a wrong thing, if we could get in trouble. But the more it went on, the more I just sort of thought, this is kind of weird and thrilling. And again, it was sort of the completion of a change that began in the early 60s with Vatican II. Changes came about from Vatican II that allowed liturgies to be said in the native language instead of the medieval language of Latin.
And today, we're seeing something that is a great leap beyond even what John Paul II has done. I mean, it seems like Francis is much more deliberately a global figure. John Paul II, at the end, was enforcing very narrow in his view of what it means to be a Catholic. Francis couldn't be more broad.
That's true. You know, the Vatican has had decades to practice putting the Pope out as a global media figure. I can tell you, as a Catholic youth, I felt like I was in a race toward righteousness that I was always losing, or I was always falling behind. I wasn't memorizing my catechism enough. I wasn't worrying about my sins enough. And this was a constant anxiety that gnawed at you as a Catholic schoolboy. And Pope Francis has said to all of his bishops and priests and other clergy, when people encounter the church, let it not be as a moment of judgment. Let it be an embrace. Let it be a question that says, not what are you doing wrong, but how can we help you? Where are you at?
So all of a sudden, Jim O'Grady breathes a sigh of relief that's been a long time coming.
Yes. And to be clear, Pope Francis will not be changing major Catholic doctrines in any major substantive way. It seems very unlikely that that will happen. He might make changes around the edges with things like divorced Catholics being able to take communion. But major doctrinal changes are probably not in the wind. Perhaps this pope is setting the groundwork for a Pope Francis II, say, to come and make other kinds of more serious changes.
So you're going to buy a pope on a rope tonight?
I'm going to see what there is for sale. I'll be interested.
Yeah.
I'll be at Madison Square Garden covering Pope Francis saying Mass for National Public Radio. Maybe I can get a keychain. I don't know.
Oh, you can aim higher than that.
A papal flashlight?
Sure. At least a bobblehead.
A bobblehead.
At least.
Maybe with lasers shooting out of the eyes?
Oh, there you go. Now you're going to get in trouble. See, you're going to go back to the guilt thing. You don't want to do that.
Right.
Jim O'Grady, features reporter for our partner WNYC. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Let's kick it.
And here's something to take with you today. Today is National One-Hit Wonder Day, which needs no explanation.
All right, stop, collaborate, and listen. I sit back with my brand new invention.
Where are they now? Vanilla Ice, Los Del Rio, and Baja Men. And here it is. Name this 1985 band. Let's just call it your aha moment. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Send me your questions, and you can follow me at Jay Hockenberry. Take us with you. Subscribe to The Takeaway podcast. Find us on iTunes. Take us with you on your commute home from work. A great way to stay up on the news. Again, find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.